This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe, Carol Norton. She's Associate Director of Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Good to have you here. Good to have you back. It's been a while since we've had you on the radio.
Too long. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I like keeping up with your organization because you are working very hard, and I have to say very successfully, to protect wild lands and places and rivers and animals and wildlife here in the American West. How did the organization, tell us a little bit about the organization.
Wild Earth Guardians' mission is to protect and restore wildlife, wild places, wild rivers, and the health of the American West. So it started 27 years ago. It still is people who are passionate about working for the wild and making the difference in the world.
And so you're working on a lot of different projects and have actually quite a history of making real substantive changes.
It's true. Sam Hitt founded the organization 27 years ago, and he's known for basically stopping old growth timbering in the Southwest, Arizona, New Mexico, maybe even stretching up into Colorado and Utah a little bit.
So have you been to some of those forests that are actually old growth forests that weren't logged out of existence?
Yes, there's some in northern New Mexico, and people don't even talk about them because they're so precious. They don't necessarily want everybody to know where they are.
Really?
It's kind of fun. But if you know where they are, they're magical. I mean, anyone who's been around a ponderosa, who's hugged a ponderosa, who's smelled that, some people say it's vanilla, some people say it's cinnamon.
Butterscotch.
Butterscotch. If you've actually been able to do that to a tree that is significantly larger than I am, it's a beautiful experience. It's very grounding.
It's also habitat for a lot of other little, I call them people, but little creatures.
It is habitat.
And not so little creatures.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, you can go walk anywhere around Santa Fe and see apert squirrels, which are those large squirrels with the tufts and the silver tail, the very big bushy tail that are really an unusual kind of animal, creature, in anywhere. And we have them here in New Mexico, which is fun. I mean, there's more charismatic species for sure. Everything from big cats to maybe wild wolves, at least in the south part of the state. So you can, birds, anything.
It's funny how conservation does seem to revolve around quote-unquote charismatic species, the kind of species that you can put on a poster or a letter or whatever, and people think that they're magnificent or cute, when in fact what we're really talking about is entire ecosystems which depend on all the different members of that place.
It's one of the ways Wild Earth Guardians works. We pick a species that if we protect that species, it will protect the entire habitat.
Yeah.
Often that species is a carnivore, a top-level predator. Because when you protect the top-level predator, you protect the whole trophic cascade, every animal that is impacted by that carnivore, and it makes a big difference.
Trophic cascade meaning the kind of like food chain, food web.
Right. So you think about wolves. Wolves chase elk. When elk aren't hanging around in riverbeds eating willows any longer, the trees come back. The trees shade the river. The river cools off. It can hold more trout. You get a pretty big impact just by protecting the wolf.
So what are some of the projects that you are working on now?
We have four programs. So Wild Rivers, Wild Places, Wildlife, and our Climate and Energy. People probably are seeing us in the news right now because of our Keep It in the Ground campaign. And our Keep It in the Ground campaign is all about keeping fossil fuels on public lands in the ground. These are our fossil fuels. And I think most Americans will believe or want those fossil fuels to be kept where they are so that we can move to a different paradigm, a sane energy future, say.
And have them be just fossils and not fuels.
Correct. So President Obama and the Interior, Sally Jewell, just put a moratorium on all coal leasing on public lands. We call that our Keep It in the Ground campaign. It's the work of many allies and a long time coming, and it's our biggest win to date.
Has that decision, do you have a sense of how much coal mining will be prevented? I mean, coal mining on private lands will not be prevented. Coal mining that's already begun or already has leases won't be stopped. Is it a big step in terms of actual numbers?
It's huge. It really is one of the final nails in the coffin of coal. There's just, without new coal leasing, it's going to go away.
Yeah.
And we're going to transition to other fuels. Probably gas in the meantime. And our next ask is for a moratorium on fracking on public lands. That, like the Keep It in the Ground coal campaign, it's a multi-year campaign. One of the things about Guardians is we think big, we act locally, and we get stuff done.
Let's talk a little bit about the way that change happens. I remember when Obama was elected, wasn't he who said change doesn't come from Washington, it comes to Washington? And there's a lot of citizens, individual citizens and citizens groups and people like Wild Earth Guardians who are doing the work that eventually results in policy shift like this one. Talk about the mechanism of how that works. I mean, how, you know, citizens are activated, how campaigns, how you do your campaigns and what happens.
Yeah, it's when Wild Earth Guardians gets passionate about a campaign, and it usually comes from one of our individual staff, they begin to, a lot of them are policy wonks, and so they begin to look, and we work almost entirely on public lands. We look at first at what might be going on that policy-wise, where are policies or laws being broken? Where do we believe that there's a moral imperative for change? And when we see something, a campaign come together, say something like the Rio Grande or wildlife or contest hunts, where you have a real moral imperative, laws that we believe are being broken, and a need for a policy shift, then we often work with the agency, government agency, usually a federal agency, sometimes state, sometimes municipal, and we work to or request a solution, to craft a solution. Many times the agency is stuck in a status quo, in the status quo, doesn't want to make change, change is hard. And we find that using our legal system can move the ball down the road. And so it is not unusual for Guardians to file a lawsuit. Our lawsuits are, we believe they're well thought out. They address real issues that you see on the land in real life, and they address laws that are actually being broken. So we're very lucky in this country to have great laws like the Endangered Species Act, like National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Water Act. They were all put there by the people for a reason. And when those laws are being broken, we feel it's our responsibility to call that out. And you sometimes, not always, but sometimes that means filing a lawsuit.
It's interesting that some of these laws have written into them enforcement procedures of exactly the kind that you're talking about. In other words, it allows the people to actually have the standing to bring a suit and enforce the law.
Standing's a very important piece of all of this. If you don't have standing, if you can't show that you have a need, a right, a harm, that's a legal term, if you aren't being impacted by the law being broken, then you can't sue.
What are some of the examples of successful lawsuits that you've brought in the past?
A very good example of a lawsuit, one that we just won, and we don't always win. Sometimes we settle, sometimes we get a precedent, sometimes we get a good precedent, sometimes a bad precedent. But an example of one that we just recently won was up in Montana, and most recently last week or maybe the week before, about lynx. So lynx are an endangered...
Lynx, the kitty.
The kitty, the big kitty.
The very big
so
kitty.
So cute. I've seen one.
Have you?
Yes, there aren't many in the American West, and I feel very lucky, and it's very motivating to me because it's inspiring to see that kind of beauty in the wildness. So up in Montana and Idaho, lynx are endangered and trapping them is illegal, but trapping is not illegal. Trapping lynx is illegal. But that's a pretty important distinction. So if you're trapping, which isn't illegal, but you're trapping lynx, there's a problem.
Yeah.
And there are solutions to that problem.
Because you can't figure out who's going to fall into your trap. I mean, you can't prevent.
And you need to. And you can.
Can you?
You can. So there are ways to use different kinds of traps and different methodologies that will actually protect different species. So most trapping is non-targeted, and that's easy, and that's the way it's mostly done. It's certainly the way it's done here in New Mexico, which is why you hear about dogs and all kinds of non-target species getting caught in them. Lynx, it's not easy, but it can be done. And so when we bring a lawsuit that says, hey, you're breaking the law, you're trapping lynx, it's very clearly stated that lynx are protected, they're endangered, you need to do something about it. The Game Commission, first in Montana and then in Idaho, really need to go back and look at what they're doing and what their regulations say. And last week, Idaho came to the table and said, you're correct, we could do better, and they've improved their regulations to reduce the amount of trapping and certainly and hopefully all trapping of lynx. So very nice win, big win for lynx, and a good impact for all other species that are being trapped as well. More monitoring, less suffering, you know, just making it a little harder to do what shouldn't be easy to do.
I think in order for something like that to be successful, you have to have enough allies who are going to actually enforce what they say they're going to do. In other words, if you have a game commission that's 100% trappers, you're not exactly going to be able to rely on them.
Game commissions are a really interesting subject, and we could talk a long time about it. It is clear in my mind, and I think Guardians does say we need game commission reform. If you look at what's happening in New Mexico, our game commission is not, it's managing species. It's not even managing species based on science. They're just managing them for a few people's benefit, basically. And that happens across the West.
Those few people being like hunters and trappers?
You know, maybe. It's hard to actually tell what's going on, because when a game commission does something like raise quotas on bears, when the current quota isn't even being met yet, then you have to ask yourself what is really going on here. And so I don't know the answer to that, who they're doing it for, but it's not science-based, and it's not certainly not for the benefit of the species. And you see interesting policy and regulation from game commissions across the West, and when you see that, Guardians wants to reform it. We would like to see conservation interests included. We'd like to see some accountability for these game commissioners, and that's a really big campaign. It's one we're very interested in. Not quite sure what it looks like yet.
And presumably scientists who study those animals.
Correct. Yes, basically everyone but the Game Commission wants some reform.
Yeah. So we're talking to Carol Norton of Wild Earth Guardians, and one of the campaigns that you have is about the Rio Grande, which some of us call the Rio Pequeñito. It's not so grande anymore. How are you looking at the river?
The Rio Grande is one of our most important, most beautiful resources in New Mexico. And there's a lot of attention in the conservation movement being paid to the Colorado River. We believe that the Rio Grande is of equal import. And so we have a campaign that is dedicated to giving the river a right to its own water. So what happens in the West is that there isn't a lot of water, and the water is assigned to different kinds of users. And often, certainly here in New Mexico, more water is assigned, given out, than is actually available. And the very last, in line are the species like the willow flycatcher or the silvery minnow.
Now, I always say this when we talk about water on the radio, but it was not until I moved to New Mexico that I learned that there was a distinction between paper water and wet water.
Yes.
Paper water is what is allocated. Wet water is what actually exists in any given year.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah.
And thank goodness for years like this, because there might actually, one might equal the other, but it's unusual. And it won't even help the species, because even if there is enough water for everybody who's been given water, it doesn't come at the right time. So right now, the Rio Grande is being managed for farming and not for cottonwoods. So if you spend any time in the Bosque, and that could be the Bosque del Apache or the Bosque in Albuquerque or further up the river, you might be noticing that the trees are aging. And that's because without a spring flood, cottonwoods will not regenerate. It's really important, not just the quantity of water, but when the water flows. So Wild Earth Guardians is working hard to get environmental flows in the river. And we've had some great successes, and we're still not there yet. We need Cochiti Dam to be managed so that water is released in the spring. So everything below Cochiti gets a spring rush flood.
Yeah. I think this whole concept of allocating water for residential use, for agriculture, for industry, and then for nature itself, and I'm not sure which order the first three are, but it's always nature itself is the last one. The idea that you could flip it drives people completely nuts, because they say, well, do you think that we should not have agriculture? Do you think that we should not be able to take showers? Should we not have water for industry? Like, how do you manage that? I mean, I'm asking you the question that everybody in New Mexico has been asking for hundreds of years, but what are your ideas on that?
You nailed it. It's really hard to say nature should get water before a farmer should get water. And it's not a dichotomy, but in New Mexico, the vast majority of the water goes to agriculture. And so that's where we're spending our time, is to see if we can reform agriculture. And what we try and do is change the frame. So humans are here. I am a human. I would like to be able to eat fresh fruit. How do we evolve the agriculture so that it uses up less water, leaving more water? So there's enough water for everything if we use it wisely.
And there are real questions about whether the food that we produce is exported or eaten in state, which actually, you're exporting water when you export fruits and vegetables.
That's right. And there's also a lot of the water is used to grow alfalfa. And then you feed the alfalfa to livestock, and livestock is used for, you know, dairy, meat. These bring up big questions about where we should be eating on the food chain, or where we could be eating on the food chain. There's also a question of economics. So if a farmer is going to raise alfalfa, he needs to grow a lot of it. He needs to use a lot of water. If the water costs what it is valued at, that would drive some decisions. If he changed to fruits or vegetables or a crop that had a higher value, it would also bring it would drive an economic model that could be very successful.
So what kinds of changes are you advocating for the Rio Grande?
So to give the Rio Grande a right to its own water, we would really like to see, we'd like to see environmental flows that would make it a fully functional river, that would provide the recreation, beauty, and just the environment ecosystems that we need here in New Mexico. 1% of New Mexico is covered by water. Over half the species need water. So it drives our lifestyle. So to be sustainable, water.
Doesn't every species need water?
Yes. Yes, that's true. Some are more directly dependent on running water.
Okay.
And that's our bottom line. Water in the river. So to get that, what do you have to do? You need to work with the governing or managing agencies, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Bureau of Reclamation, and some of the local agencies as well, to find ways to provide incentives to use less water where we're currently using it, to leave more water in, and to have it flow at the times where it's most beneficial to the species that need it.
I think it's really important to talk, when we talk about water in an arid state or semi-arid state like New Mexico, to understand that it really kind of is a zero-sum game. There are a lot of things that aren't. So like if you have the economy of a city, you know, that can change. You bring in new business or business leaves. I mean, it's not a zero-sum thing. Population, depending on what kind of policy you have, you can have a burgeoning or a shrinking population. But water, you can't just like flip a switch and say, we're going to have more water now, or we're going to have policies that encourage the migration of water to New Mexico.
It's true. What's interesting is that it's humans who manage the water. So if you deal with the human systems, it provides more abundance in the water system. So for instance, Jen Pels is our Rio Grande campaign director. And one of the things that she does really well is she goes and talks to people. So she spends a lot of time listening to what's needed and what people's concerns are, what might work for them, what might not work for them. And in doing so, has found ways to introduce new ways of looking at what we already have that just by perspective create abundance.
These are very interesting issues and very complex issues. And I mean, I've been doing radio for a long time and I'm continually finding new ways to learn to wrap my head around them. I mean, and then there's a lot of citizens whose basic perspective is, I want to be involved in such a way that my work and my living is beneficial, or at least not detrimental to the land and, you know, the area that I live on. How can people do that, both through involvement in organizations like yours and in general? What's your perspective on that?
You know, the first thing I would say is go outside. It's so important. Go get something to float on and float the river. Walk out into the hills around your house. So important. Take a road trip up to Chaco. If you're particularly interested in organizing or being part of a movement, and we do consider ourselves a movement, we think that we're moving in a direction that's going to allow compassion and coexistence with all species. We have campaigns like our Frack Free New Mexico campaign, Frack Free Chaco specifically, Frack Free Santa Fe National Forest, where we need voices. We need people to show up at rallies. We need people to go to the legislature over the next, you know, 30 days. We need people who will write editorials, who will write letters to the editor, who will pen op-eds.
Yeah. Well, if people want more information, they can write to, or they can go to the website, wildearthguardians.org. And Carol Norton is the associate director of that fine organization. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.